Angela. All right. So I'm glad to have everybody together today. And so today I'm going to tell you about first time actually working with a real monitoring data set trying to use next generation DNA sequencing for inventorying. The plan is monitoring terrestrial arthropods. We've been working towards this, still a work in progress, but we've made some progress. So that's what I'll be reporting on, mostly in methods talk. Here's the general outline. Let's stand in the way. Stand back here. So I'm not going to belabor the problem that I'll be trying to address, the taxonomic bottleneck, sometimes called the taxonomic impediment. Mostly concentrate on methods and give some thoughts afterwards as a review on how it works, how it worked for us, and where we're trying to go from there, what needs to change. Okay. Said I would not belabor this, so I'm just going to give one slide. Just to say that as important as primary taxonomy is and the exploratory process of finding out what lives where and looking for new species and the species that are new distribution changes and such through classical taxonomy and old-fashioned exploring and collecting specimens, putting them in museums, getting them to experts. That needs to happen. It needs to continue to happen. More of it needs to happen. But for the purpose of routine monitoring, which is where I'm trying to head, it's just impractical. I mean, it takes too long. Robin can attest to this. We're trying to answer an ecological question using the soil fauna mites. I've had a lot of trouble with it, trying to say things about everything at the landscape scale at the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge using conventional means. So we're looking at using next-generation sequencing to address, overcome this problem. We're not the only ones trying to do this. So I got this data set from Tetlin National Wildlife Refuge, where I've never been there. I had no part in the sampling. But they went, they had this, I can't see it very well at all. There's a grid on the refuge here. This is their map of 27 points. It's a grid that extends over all of interior Alaska and all over the U.S. It's the Forest Inventory and Analysis grid, their sampling grid. They started a pilot project in 2014 in interior. They're looking at extending their forestry survey into interior Alaska. They did a pilot in 2014 using remote sense data to try and cover all of Alaska. That's really what they're trying to hit. But the manifestation of that on Tetlin was a grid of 27 points. What we had them do, we had FIA sample for insects as well while they were there. So they went to these 27 sites, and the kind of core of their sites, they do a lot of work on their sites that they go to. But the core is a circular plot, a 24-foot radius circular plot. We split that in half. It took one SweepNet sample on either side. So we have corresponding samples that should have pretty similar fauna in them. So they had two vials. One vial they still have in the freezer, still at their office in Tok. The other vial got sent to a lab. All the insects were ground up, DNA extracted, and then they worked with that. And that's all I saw. I haven't even seen any of these specimens, haven't seen the vials or anything. So first, this is our target part of the genome. We were targeting part of the cytochrome oxidase 1 mitochondrial gene in the mitochondria. But using these next-gen methods, it's hard to get the whole 658 base pair barcode region. This is a picture of several of the different primer sets or regions of that gene that have been proposed and used for next-generation sequencing. We use this small one. It's 157 base pairs. It's one that's one of the earlier ones in the literature, which this isn't very long ago, like 4 years ago. So this is changing very quickly. But that was available to us commercially through a commercial vendor. They do this as part of their regular business, so we tried. Okay, so here's the outline of the methods that we used. So these 27 samples were sent to the lab to perform the sequencing. And the very first part of the analysis, dumping us a bunch of sequences. I put these and I used this Galaxy platform, which is a freely available platform on the web. It's a cloud-based DNA processing platform. It's free. You can sign up for it. It's on TAC, same place that Arctos is. It's Texas Advanced Computing Center, which is great because I'm on a laptop and this is gigabytes of data, and I read on and I'm processing it. It says 126 gigabytes of RAM. That's great. It processes all this data in minutes. It's amazing. It's amazing. So I was able. Once it took me weeks to figure out how to do it and what needed to be done, because this is not my area of expertise. But once I understood what needed to be done, I could run all those samples in basically a day and end up with names at the end of the day. And most of that time was spent uploading the data at the beginning, and that took a couple hours because it's a gigabyte, and downloading the data at the end. The processing was remarkably fast, which is where I want to go for monitoring. That's if it needs to be routine, and we're not talking 27 sites, we might be talking hundreds or thousands of sites. It needs to be fast. So that's two parts, so the sequencing and the sequence processing on Galaxy. The other part that you need a good library. You have to have a library to compare. You just have to get the soup of sequences out of these files, and they are no more than a bunch of sequences, a bunch of text, until you can compare them with a good library. And these tools require you to provide the library. So I took a library, I built a library from, I downloaded off the all the sequences from BOLD, it's the Barcode of Life Data Systems. I downloaded everything from Alaska, British Columbia, Yukon, Chukotka, and Kamchatka, which was 200 and some odd thousand sequences. Processed those down, de-replicated it, so you're just concatenating all this, compressing, just getting the unique sequences, which is 166,000. Still needs a lot of work, but it's fun. I'm actually using the data that Derek's going to talk about later. And here are the results so far. So we got from 26 samples. One of them didn't sequence for whatever reason. I still don't know why. I haven't had that part of it. But we got 84 Latin names at various levels of resolution. So some in species resolution, some just Diptera, some just Lepidoptera. Of those, 53 were species names. They fit into they matched 118 bins, which is BOLD, which we talked about. That's their clustering algorithm. So it's at the species resolution more or less. It's analogous to species. Their species resolution clusters. So this is the more realistic number, the 118 bins. Many of those had no Latin name associated with them, or very coarse names, like Diptera. So that's the more realistic number of what we were actually catching. And I should also say it's only the ones that matched. So there are a number of sequences that didn't match. They don't even end up getting added up in this analysis here. But for today's, they're not in here. That ended up being one to nine species per plot. We're trying to think about, based on morphology, so this is including immature specimens, damaged specimens. These are sweet net samples, they're kind of messy. Not as many as we'd like, but that's a good start. That's actually pretty good compared to what I did by hand. We can tell them at Tetlin that their most common insect were mosquitoes. They'll be glad to hear that. They probably knew that. But of course, that's biased. They're attracted to the collectors. And all what's nice too is all this data, I'm going to put it on NCBI, so all the sequence data, we can publish that. So it'll be available if anybody wants to look at it again. You can always rerun this, you can download the data and run it through Galaxy yourself if you wanted to check it again. Just repeatability is a great thing for monitoring. And if we find anything, I will be posting on Arctos all the observations. I'll probably put them in the observation part, but we'll be talking about that. The data will be available. So just for a quick summary of what we got. We got mostly spiders and Diptera. Flies were the best represented group, which fits with what you tend to get with sweetness samples. But spiders were very well represented. They just sequenced really well with that particular primer set. Which brings up the point that there is an issue of primer bias. This primer works better for flies and spiders than it does for some other groups. So you have to remember that this is a sweep net sample. It's biased towards what you tend to get in a sweep net sample, and biased towards whatever those particular primers sequence well. And This is a map of those results on the 27 sites, both in terms of yellow are the species. I'm sorry, I don't have a scale here to show you how many, but it, the species goes from 1 to 9. And the number of bins, those are those operational taxonomic units or clusters at each site. That's just to show the point that you can, that it's very quick processing of data from a bunch of different places. And the most interesting result as far as identifications was, I think this is the first collection date of the black gray skeletonizer in Alaska, which is widespread across northern North America now. It's a European moth, pest on blackberries and raspberries, other species of rubus, and it also on birch and such too. It's kind of a generalist, but mostly prefers those in the rose family. And it's widespread across, it's known from Alberta and in BC, there are specimens from BC. But now we've got specimens from Tetlin, which is right on the Canadian border. But there was a record in Arctos from the same genus from Sitka this year. So it was actually reported first, but ours had the first collection date. But it seems like a new pest arriving in Alaska, perhaps on its own 2-4 weeks. So the quick review is, overall, I was really pleased that it worked so well and worked so quickly. There were concerns with it. But the advantages were, it was very quick, very repeatable in that you can run the same sequences again. And we actually had a mistake in the lab running, actually some data from Kenai. And so they were able to run an extraction again and repeat the whole sequencing process, and we got almost exactly the same results. So it does seem to be very repeatable, at least with the same lab and hardware. And it's cheap. This was $95 a sample, and that price seems to continue going down over the last few years. I've heard it really is getting cheaper. A problem was that the region, the primer set that we used that got that 157 base pair sequence, that sequence is too short for species identification a lot of the time. So you get many ambiguous sequences where a number of species, even at the family level, would share the same or very similar sequences. So it's too short. Not always though. If you're looking at degraded DNA, like if you're looking at if you're going to try and look at bird feces and see what they're eating, that's where they've been using this primer set was in bat guano. You're getting shorter sequences of DNA anyway. Now, if you go for a long sequence, you're not going to find it very much. So short sequences are better for that. You get coarser IDs, but there's that trade-off. So still a good primer set for that. But there are some much better contenders out there now. There's a paper that just came out this fall on using a 313 base pair. They actually compared a number of potential primer sets for this kind of work. And there's a very promising 313 base pair. So there are a couple of promising ones, but I'm going to be running this one this winter on some Kenai specimens. I'm going to try that out. But this field is changing just rapidly, just dizzyingly. So I was talking with our sequencing lab just a couple weeks ago, and they just got a new piece of hardware, and now they're going to be able to run up to 10,000 base pair sequences. Which for our application, we're still probably looking at 658 base pair or something close to that. But it's changing very quickly. I did have a concern I didn't list up here, which was demultiplexing. So it's sometimes, I didn't explain how those 26 samples, they have a PCR run on them with a tagged primer set. So there's a tag. A particular DNA sequence for each sample, so all the samples get their own tag. They all get stuck, put in one lane of these massively parallel sequencers, and then you have to pull them apart at the end. And there can be errors in that. For a long time, I was trying to make sure false presences are a real problem for monitoring. So that's saying a species was there when it really wasn't there. That's a much bigger deal than failing to catch it to pick it up when it's there. They were able to convince me through their methods that there were not demultiplexing issues. I found where some of the issues were. Anyway, not so much of a concern. It can be dealt with well. PCR primer bias is always going to be an issue. It's both, but you can think about it both ways. So any primer set is going to amplify some species and groups better than other species and groups. And in some ways, that's great when you're targeting something, or you want to make sure and not get maybe human DNA in it or something. But you have to be aware of that issue. So you may, for whatever project you're working on, you might want a real broad primer set, or you might want a pretty narrow primer set. I'd like a broader one than what we ended up with on this project, in which the 313 base pair one, that candidate, that was actually used like on coral reefs. It amplifies a bunch of different phyla of animals, which hopefully will be okay. We'll see. And the Alaska Sequence Library does need a lot of work. Even when I was able to download a lot of the identifications that are provided for free or publicly or free of course, and we can refine those pretty quickly. I did some of that, but we both need to collect more species, identified species. This is what Derek's been working on, he'll talk about. Need more of that work on the library. But it works great. I'm just really happy to be using that library. It's fast. But I want to end with the prophecy that this is the way that things are going to be done. This is going to be, if you look at the trends and how this technology is changing and where it can be useful, I think this is really the way things are going to be done in the future for routine monitoring. That there's still going to be a place for primary research, and depending on your question, but for a lot of routine monitoring, I think this is going to be the way to go. It's continuing to get better. We're not hitting a ceiling yet on what can be done and how cheap they can be and how well it can work. So, and by acknowledging USDA Forest Service, who did the field work, our Alaska, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Alaska Regional Monitoring Program funded this sequencing effort of Tetlin's arthropod samples from 2017 or 2014. I want to give Derek a lot of credit for putting together most of what we have in the Alaska Sequence Library, or at least a huge part of it. And it's actually my supervisor, John Morton, who pushed this through. He got the Alaska Regional folks, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service folks, to get this funded. So he deserves that credit. I intentionally provided links and references so you can check a lot of this out. It's a lot of why the formatting is the way it is, so that once it's on the web, it's easy to see what was done. You can actually get to some of the sequences and such. That's all I've got. Go ahead.
A couple questions. One, abundance. So, any idea how many individuals were in each of those samples?
No, there's a lot of bias. So, I do get numbers at the end of how many reads. So, you get. So, this particular, I forget the number of how many reads. I think it was still under a million reads that I got on this one at the beginning. It was condensed. The matching data set, so those that actually matched. I did look at those of 600,000, I think, reads. And that gets broken down by each cluster, too. So I can say how many of this species, how many reads we obtained. But there's a whole lot of bias. So whatever those primers tend to amplify well, you're going to have much more of them, even if it's... And for example, I have no idea on the bias because I never even saw the sample.
Well, it's beautiful that they swept on both sides of
yes.
each plot. So the others are undamaged.
Yep.
You could get those, even if you got a subset of those. It would
yep.
be really great to just count them out. I mean, not bother with the identification. So
sure,
much,
even at a course level.
Yeah, like how many individuals are there? Because I think in terms of selling this as an idea, the bottleneck issue is very... The formula is based on the number of specimens that you're physically having to deal with. And the scaling of this, the fact that you can, for that price, get that many specimens, but we don't really know what the number is, but
right.
some very large number of specimens processed, whereas you know at the museum level, we just have kind of a, it doesn't scale up. I mean, it's the same price to do 10 specimens as to do, per specimen, as to do 1,000 specimens. You don't get a benefit from large samples the way you do.
Sure, which also, so help it illustrates one of the, it's both a cost and a benefit of this kind of method for monitoring, so you don't get, and it's never going to be great on the quantitative end, I don't think. There is some work on it. Actually, the newer PCR virus would be less of an issue, potentially, with that PacBio instrument, the one that does the longer reads. It's actually PCR-free, it's direct PCR. I don't know much about it yet, I haven't read too much, but I think you will actually get better abundance data out of it. But with the current stuff, we know it's biased, but the point I wanted to make in the answer to that is you get a good picture of what was in that vial, of the big picture. Rare species tend to be missed, or at least they have a high probability of being missed, having very few number of reads, and we often filter those out because often the really low count ones are noise. So they're not going to be great at looking for the rare stuff, but it's good for showing the big picture of what was there. If you're looking at diet analysis or for monitoring, that makes sense. But if you're looking for a particular species, like is often done in EDRR, that's where eDNA might be a more appropriate method.
Does it have a size bias as well? Like you talked about a numerical bias, like if the organism is really small as opposed to really big organisms, is that going to work with it as well?
Certainly. So it's the amount of DNA going in. Yeah. So. But it really is biased. Like I did a few of these samples at Kenai, and you'd have a big Elasmocephalus, the green stink bug. It's a big animal, and it was alive versus some fragments of dead insects with spider webs in that sample. I only got like a few reads from that Elasmocephalus. You know, it's a big animal, and comprised a lot of that sample. So that one just didn't amplify well. Where some little fungus gnats, I don't think there were very many of them. Got plenty of reads from those. That's a bias issue, but certainly that's how much goes in matters. The numbers in the beginning do matter.
Another question is,
but Molly.
Oh, sorry.
I know this isn't really quite the focus of what you're doing, but I was curious about the map you showed where you had a lot more species and bins showing up in certain areas than others. Do you have any idea about the characteristics of those sites? Are you planning to take a look at that, or are you more focused on kind of comparing this method?
Well, for now, this is my focus on this was methods, just trying it out. But certainly, I haven't done it with this more recent iteration, but I had started to, because we have very good vegetation data and photographs of all the plots. So even though I wasn't there, we have pretty detailed info. So I did want to, we are going to go there. I'm going to try and, I'm hoping to work this up better. This is not a final analysis. And hopefully publish it. We'll see.
Do you by any chance remember the name of the 313 base pair primer you were doing?
Yeah, well, it's on the presentation here. It was the best one. So Brandon Ma, I saw them right here. It's this green pair.
Okay.
It's the MLCO.
Yeah, I tried those and I couldn't get those to work. I'm doing Sanger. But I have been able to get old museum specimens to amplify with the MLEP, I think the 253, and the mini bar, which is the 150 something.
Okay.
I have been able to get both of those for curious.
But doing there. Sanger for older?
I've gotten them to amplify some so far.
Okay.
I haven't tried to sequence them yet, but very soon I can let you know how they work.
Okay, great. But you had poor success with that one.
Just didn't work at all. I don't know why.
Okay.
Could be a bias for
Yeah, so some of them are like this particular, the one that I use, the ZBGA set, isn't very good for beetles. It does work somewhat. I got a few beetles.
Yeah, but it's interesting that, it's part of the 658 normal CO1, and that I can get to work, but not the 350 square chunk of that.
So, yeah, my other question is, since the library is incomplete, as the library grows to completion, it would make sense to rerun your sample through the library again.
Yes.
At some periodic interval.
Oh yeah.
To see if you're picking up species that you couldn't match previously.
Yeah. In fact, what I didn't show here is I actually did that. So I just ran this on Monday. Monday and Tuesday. So I ran it once on Monday. Ran to up this step. And you get a set of sequences that didn't match as well, the clusters that had no match. And so I started going through and finding those sequences and querying against Bold and GenBank. and then pulling sequences from often they'd be Ontario or Alberta, where there were where they would I would have a match over there, and adding those to the Alaska Library, which you still there are trade-offs about how you want to build your library. You don't want to take everything because then you'll start matching some weird stuff in South America that like in other it's seriously I did some of that. But so I already have, and I went through with where some of the names are some really abundant clusters, you know, really abundant animals that showed up with no good name on them, or they're just Diptera or family resolution. So I went through and took the time to try and get good names on them, and then ran it once again. So I did two iterations of this step. I ran it, improved my library a little bit, ran it again, but needs a lot of work on the library end.
Very cool.
Thank you. Oh, go ahead.
Just one more question. Do you have any comparison as far as the number of species you found through traditional taxon methods with the same kind of sample? Like, just to put that number in context, we found that it was an average of things.
Sure, yeah. So. That's what I did in my master's work was actually sweeten that sample work on the FI grid, so similar, slightly smaller, you know, pretty close. You know, we certainly got more species than that, but I didn't do as well as far as species names. I didn't get 1 to 9. I think I averaged a little lower. I mean, I had more. I had several. I'm forgetting what the average number of families and genera I had. I can't remember that now. But as far as if you're looking at species name, this actually did a little bit better than me as a graduate student, and that reflects on me some too. Some other graduate students could probably do better, but these methods, as poor as they are, I mean, 1 to 9 isn't that many species per plot, but that's actually not too bad either.
So you think that's about how many species you were getting from your own sweep samples?
Like, yeah, I think I actually
you're doing like morpho species identifications.
Because you get a lot of, you know, you get females where sometimes you need the male. You get lots of immature, you know, lots of immature cicadellidae, and I bet that the Lepidoptera I'm getting, I bet these are caterpillars, you know, larvae. But if there was an egg on a leaf that ended up in the sampling, that would have been it too. So even though there are issues in some sequences that you're never going to get a species name on because it's just too ambiguous, it in some ways it makes up for it in being able to deal just as well with all these immatures and damaged specimens as well that you just can't get to morphologically. It's just a mangled thing on a pin that nobody's going to be able to work with. Thanks a lot.